I'd like to call this talk Elixir. And that means I have to describe what Elixir means. So Elixir might be when you bring together different forces and or substances in a way that brings out, let's say, the best, or brings out something especially powerful or even magical in the combination or in those things. So the combination becomes something else that's maybe just left with life-giving qualities. So, or we can just think of it in a more folk tale kind of way. So it would be like the magic potion, the magic liquid. That you'd have to work hard and go through the challenges to find and recognize and bring home. So sometimes we find it but don't recognize it. And sometimes we recognize it but don't know how to bring it home. And then just for fun, I want to add a kind of subtitle, like a second, not a subtitle, but a second title, after the bell rings. The first time I received meditation instructions from a living person rather than from a book, at that time when I was starting, there weren't all these videos and there wasn't internet and all of that. It's funny to think of that. But strangely, the minister at my church had given me a book by Ram Dass, who was an American psychology professor who was into experimenting with psychedelics and who met his guru, Neem Karoli Baba, whose ashram is nearby. And I was trying to follow the instructions in that book, one of those books. Then I went to India and I received instructions from a person, which was still not easy to understand. But we meditated as a group together with instructions twice a day, 1 hour in the morning, 1 hour in the evening. And in the morning, especially when the bell rang after the hour, it was breakfast time. And it was a really good kitchen and really good breakfast. And chai and everything. And even so, I found myself staying longer and longer after the bell rang in the hall. Probably, I don't remember, but I think probably I was like something like that, like not sitting up anymore. Maybe I was back or maybe I was forward, but I probably wasn't sitting up straight, which was the one thing that everybody agreed on, is that you should sit up straight. So I was definitely not sitting up straight, one way or the other. And very aware of, as a member of a group that had gone to study in India, we'd been taught so I wouldn't be lying down in the hall. That was clearly so. So I was crouched over probably. And it's not that it was thought through. So it happened that way. I was crouched over and. What was happening internally was something that I think I won't actually describe, because putting it into words makes it sound like a particular kind of direction. the important thing is that the bell had rung after an hour of meditation, and I had left my meditation posture, and everyone had left the hall to have chai and whatever for breakfast. Sometimes, even at that time, in 1987, cinnamon rolls, which is really, if you know Bodh Gaya from Susan Bodh Gaya, that long ago, cinnamon rolls in Bodh Gaya at that time is really like something to go out of the meditation hall for. So it was clear that what I was doing after the meditation was not meditation. That was clear. I wasn't sitting up, the bell had rung, everyone else was gone. And what was happening inside me had nothing to do with the technique that we were using, which was noting. So the in-breath is coming in, the abdomen is expanding, rising and falling, rising, falling. And what was happening internally was not purely a reaction against what had just happened in the meditation. It wasn't like, oh, thank God, that's over. Now I can do something else that's more juicy. It was much more juicy, but it wasn't just a reaction against something that I didn't like. I was only 20 and I didn't have that kind of sort of post-industrial cynicism or confidence to think that after a couple of weeks of receiving meditation instructions that I could put it down. I had questions, but I didn't look down on what we were doing at all. So that's one example that I want to give to start with. And then after that, there was a few months where we had different kinds of meditation instructions, a few weeks at a time, from very different traditions. And then some traveling, and then I went back to Bodh Gaya and did retreat. And it was my first longer retreat. It was going to be a 10-day retreat. It ended up being a 20-day retreat because I loved it so much. But before I went in, I thought I would either sort of die or go insane or leave or get enlightened. Those were the options in my mind. Because the 2 days that we'd done of retreat during the few months before had been so intense. So I never imagined that once I actually started from the very first evening, I would be sure that, of course, I was going to do both 10-day retreats, one after the other, with so much more of a stream than what I thought it would be. I thought it would just be pressure, 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 poof, some kind of explosion, the end. And on that retreat, we also received instructions, different kinds of instructions that I tried to follow and I had questions about. Like, I remember getting instructions about really being aware of, let's say, the breath, and wondering, how am I supposed to be fully aware of the breath when you're talking? Because I'm also hearing your voice. How can I do both? So I remember that kind of really genuine question that we forget to have the more retreats we do. Like, it's the kind of first retreat question that's actually really important to honor and to recover. And that's a lot of what I'm talking about right now. So on those first retreats, it wasn't only the very first one, but especially on the first one, I had more freedom in a certain way. And so, because I knew I didn't know what I was doing, I knew I didn't know how to do the technique, I knew that I wasn't doing very well. And at lunchtime especially, and again, it's interesting, I don't know if it's some masochistic part of my personality or something, but it was really cold and people got sick and I was definitely wearing every single piece of clothing that I had every day, the same. And we weren't given hot water in those days to bathe in. So I probably wasn't bathing very much. It was just wearing all the clothes that I had and kind of walking like this. And still being cold. But so at lunchtime, it was usually, some days, many days was sunny. And there were lawns in the temple that people would go eat their lunch on. You were allowed to go on the lawns and eat lunch. But I was so into doing what they told me, partly, which was walking really slowly and mindfully. And so I didn't get very far very fast. So I would get my plate of really, really good food and sit down in a nearby spot, which was really strangely, if you would look at it, in the shade, sitting on a concrete ground, leaning against a concrete wall, and eating really, really slowly. Not hardly aware that all these people were like in the sun. So there's the weirdness of that in myself that it didn't, I could have done the same thing. It was a long 50 meters to go, but I could have gone that 1,500 meters to the sun too. But what happened at lunchtime was much more important than like getting warm or being cold or walking 50 more meters or not. Even if it would have been a kindness for someone to like get me to the sun one time. So it was partly from the fact that we were encouraged to eat slowly and feel everything that was happening as we were eating and everything that happened when we did anything. But food is one of those things where there's so much going on. And it was partly reflection and imagination and gratitude about how much went into that was on the plate. And how many people were in that, and how many creatures were in that, and how many thousands of years were in that, and how much dirt was in that. That was one thing that was fascinating to me, that we do every day, pick things up basically off the ground or even out of the ground, and we actually put it in our mouth, and we actually swallow it. And we have not only no problem with that, but we put a lot of refinement around it being a really special thing. So I loved feeling the earthiness and the connectedness and the also disembodiment, really, of actually being aware of the actual process of receiving food on a plate and into the body, that it's so much not what I thought, and so much more to think about also. And strangely and sadly, I find that the more retreats I did, the less I did that. The less time was spent with lunch. Because that wasn't given much attention in the instructions. We weren't told not to do it. But we also weren't particularly told very often about how important that could be. And I'm not saying people should have told me to. But it feels a little bit like how there are playgrounds for children and there are not playgrounds for adults, really. There are certain kinds of entertainment for adults, but they're not just like playgrounds for adults so much. And so I get to go now to playgrounds. I have permission to be there. I'm not looked at kind of like, what's this weird adult doing around the children? Because I'm there with the kids. And it makes the question stronger for me. Why wouldn't there be actually playgrounds? Not just like for serious sports, but playgrounds that are big enough for adults to play on, that are different from playgrounds that are for children. And or, why is it that we don't play? So children also don't need playgrounds to play. A lot of children don't have playgrounds, and a lot of the playgrounds in India are not actually safe to play on. When we go to playgrounds in India, I always just run my hand along the slide, for example, and usually there's like sharp metal sticking out because it's rusted through or whatever. And so that slide we don't go on. This swing, let's check the swing. But there don't need to be also playgrounds to have permission to play. But there can be, I think the word play and the word elixir need to be held together and just considered together. And this, like, second title, After the Bell Rings. When we have permission, so having permission not to follow instructions. Having permission not to have a schedule. And then on a retreat, when the schedule ends, so the last bell rings, or the bell rings before the break for lunch where there's time, and the space is still kind of held. So the bell rings, and is there like some kind of sigh of relief, or is there some kind of, what is there? Because there is space is held. You might be rested by now, or you might have hit the second wave of exhaustion that you've come across, which happens. We realize, we stumble across another pocket of accumulated exhaustion, and we But sometimes we're rested and the bell rings and the schedule's over. And then what? So then a third example that I wanted to mention from my early days with meditation practice, formal meditation practice. So after that 20-day retreat and then some more time in India, enough time in India that I missed the beginning of the second semester in college. So then I had not just the summer break, so not just the normal rhythm that I'd had my whole life, my whole school life. But I had some extra months, so I had, for the first time in my life, 5 months with no plan and no one telling me what I should be doing. I went back from India. There was, school was in the middle, so I wasn't there. I was gonna go back to college in September, but I had 5 months. And to me, it's really striking that I was 20, and this is the first time that I remember this happening in my whole life, that I was aware of having time, that no one, there was no pressure to do something particular, there was no direction given. And so what happened? So that's, it's a good question for now, where there's still a bit of retreat left for some of you and a lot left for some of you. To play with opening up that space where there's not any outside or inside pressure, and there's not any there's not a direction that's given. And then what happens? Does that make sense? Do you feel the importance of that? I think that there is some kind of elixir that can be called our path that starts to come out in those moments. And even when it is a reaction against, if we've done a more tough or pressurized kind of practice, and then the bell rings and we go, ugh. So even when there's a sense of relief or some kind of reactionary movement, And maybe especially when there isn't particularly a reaction against what I've just practiced, and now the bell has rung and that time is over and I'm free. Technically, kind of. On paper, I'm free. So then also a kind of momentum or fragrance from what we've just been doing during that meditation, what you've just been doing during that meditation, what you turned on or tried to turn on in yourself, that now we are giving permission for it to go off, that some kind of fragrance from that could kind of come through into the so-called free time. And a very pure stream could come through then. And when I say pure stream, I'm thinking of like a stream of water that's clear and clean. Not like, if we start to think of being pure, spiritually pure, it can be complicated. But just like natural purity of a stream that just come out of the ground. And so it's not necessarily clean of dirt and leaf and stick. And part of the pure streamness is that I'm not aware of myself as doing a meditation practice in that moment. Another way to say that is there's not the spiritual ego present in the same way. And so what can occur in that pure stream moment is that things we get caught up in otherwise, so pure stream, oh, but there's blockage, or there's not blockage, or I've got to work on the blockage, or I don't know where I'm going or where I've come from or why. Or there's dirt in the water. These things aren't issues in that, in a pure stream, period. And so this is in a big way, a third continuation of the talk that I started, the first talk, the second talk, the third talk. It's still that like fire and food and what's left. It's still that talk. And so what we ended with last time about non-resistance, when there's the removal of resistance or the release of resistance or the seeing through the resistance or the disbelief in the resistance. So just out of curiosity, noticing when we're not meditating, but there's still something going on. That ends up having a kind of absorbed quality or focused or clear or streaming or authentic living sense that later we could describe that way. We could then reflect on what is it we do in meditation that gets in the way, that actually brings about resistance. Are there any questions yet or comments?
I was just going to say, I think sometimes we have a sense of meditation as work.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And it's hard because it's work.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of the freedom away. Allowing things to happen away. You see it that way. And it's kind of a hindrance in itself.
Yeah. So sometimes there is work. Sometimes it is work, let's say. And what's important and what Lenny's pointing out is when we're coming from a place of, like we spoke about last time, like I spoke about last time, of something's wrong, we've got to fix it. Or when we're coming from a place of, so in the art from Japan called Jinshin Jitsu, they talk about feeling for a wider harmony. So with a stream, let's say a clear stream flow, there are things in the way, but we don't take the time to consider it an obstacle or to tell a story about it being in the way, or, and the water goes around or goes through or moves it or something happens. Sticking with the stream, even if it takes a while for the water to build up and then overflow, there's no stopping it. And there's a staying with that no stopping it, living quality. Rather than a jumping to, this is in the way. Something's wrong. And if we can feel how often and how much of the resistance and the problem has to do with our taking the fact of obstacles personally, taking it as a personal insult or put down, or as something that shakes our personal confidence in the living stream, that there's an obstacle. Even when we know that there are obstacles sometimes. And so, like, we could say, like, kind of, at least half of our work is to stop work. And that frees enormous energy for work, for creativity, for accepting challenges as a kind of enlivening chance to be stretched to a wider harmony, to be dropped to a more subtle place, to feel a wider harmony. And so with the word elixir, there's a sense that out of anything can be drawn the necessary magical part or substance that's needed in the magic liquid. So we come up against a rock that seems to block us or stop us. And if we're staying with this elixir quality, the pure streamness, it's like, thank you, goodbye. The lovely, graceful understanding, powerful understanding in Ayurveda that everything. So not just things, but also times of day, any kind of context or any kind of situation or anything in form. Any kind of food, any way of preparing the food with any kind of mind state, etc. can be medicine or poison, depending on the need of the individual, depending on the situation of the individual. The individual person, group, ecosystem, etc. So just remembering from the last talk about feeling the chance to meet anything, including difficult emotions. But we could also talk about difficult people. We could talk about difficult times of day. We could talk about wonderful people, wonderful times of day. And in a way, wouldn't it be interesting if it ends up actually that it's a harder challenge to meet wonderful people in a way that's medicinal instead of poisonous? I have the feeling that there's some truth there. Our relationship to people we experience as wonderful, or experience as mind states, anything, food, whatever, that we experience as wonderful. I think there's a lot of, with a lot of ease, we get entangled. So easily we get entangled. And we also, again, take it as a chance to get into a sense of lack. You're so wonderful. I would never be so wonderful. And why not? I've been working so hard. Or how come you got it so easy? Or you're so lucky that you had it so hard so you can be so, or whatever. You know? The sense of gap and separation and distance and wonderful seems then so far away, and then so much projection can go so wild and big. But especially that, the chance for the feeling of competition. And then we've made a break with a potentially empowering, helpful, friendly relationship, as well as being unsupportive to someone who maybe they are really wonderful and it would be good if they had friends. So in the Buddhist tradition, when they talk about metta, maitri, friendship, the far enemy is hatred. So the opposite is hatred. The near enemy is envy. So just feeling where we have a hard time with experiencing difference of any kind, but if it's difference and it's wonderful, then it's easy that we take it as a put down, as a sense of poverty, instead of allowing some kind of friendship to be extended in the sense of not just, yeah, like it could be allowed to come forth and without necessarily hierarchy. Without gap or distance. So I'd mentioned last time this Tibetan Buddhist teaching of meeting experiences. And I said we'd come back to it because it was getting too long. So I talked last time about the hammock, where we practice truly letting things be, which is one form of non-resistance, honesty about our filters, and then dropping aside the way that we filter and get pulled out or push ourselves out to be overly active, overly alert. And seemingly opposite, but quite the same, was the kind of going towards. And really, it's about going towards an eating, going towards an eating our experience. But it's not actually like being drawn out. It's being willing to be so exposed. So that means feeling confident or safe in with anything. So even my worst inner enemy, so even my worst rage or self-hatred or fear, insecurity, embarrassment, loneliness, shame, etc. That there could be, even if I am afraid of it, there could be something in us that knows there's nothing to lose also in meeting it as it is. Or in the this-ness, is the way I talked about it last time. That's what I called the talk last time, this. So in the this-ness, instead of the that-ness of even a really difficult emotion or mind state. So the first step is called seeing. So seeing, for example, fear, here it comes, but not just letting it come and eat me or attack me in its own timing and rhythm, but okay, here you come, here I come. What do you want? A sense of it being, Chögyam Trungpa talks about it being a normal pattern of mind, a normal pattern in the human mind, a pattern that happens in the human mind, not only the human mind, a normal pattern that happens in mind, also in animals. So there's already a sort of tossing aside the usual filters, like the story, or like my sense of not wanting to be overwhelmed by my own emotion. That would be embarrassing or not okay as a good meditator or whatever, as a good person even. So it's partly just to say clearly and directly, yes, you exist, you happen, and you're happening. That's the seeing of it here, yes. Just to acknowledge it, this pattern of mind. The second one is interesting, called, hearing. The image, the metaphor is hearing. So going from just seeing, yes, I acknowledge that you exist as a pattern of mind. And here you are. Hearing it is actually, the way I've been talking about things this week, getting inside it. And the way Chögyam Trungpa talks about it is like feeling the pulsation of it. So it would be like letting that, the wave or the pulsation, so the energy of the experience, also meet directly, like actually come in. So it's like another shade less of resistance. Not just that you happen, but that I feel you as an energy. So even less story is involved. There, at that point, is not even a name, really. So this is what, at most, we could say, this is what I have called fear, this pulsation. The next step is smelling, the next step in this metaphor for fearlessly meeting experience, is smelling it. And what that is what happens next. When we feel the energy rather than the story, rather than the that-ness, but the this-ness, and then we even let it kind of have us, let's say. So we feel the energy of it fully, which is already a skill that we develop through experience to get to that point. The smelling it is what happens next, which is like, something, this is not only what I thought. There's something interesting going on. So our curiosity is awakened. Our curiosity is given room. Trungpa talks about it as like, as if we smell something cooking in the kitchen and it smells good. Which is different from even seeing the food or hearing the food be prepared or whatever. But smelling it is a more wordless kind of primal place. And so when we have already met the energy as an energy. We find that there is a kind, there's something friendly. So our resistance has dropped enough that we're less unfriendly towards the fear. We're less suspicious of the anger. There's more actual meeting, less separation, less gap, less projection, less story, less distance. And so there's aliveness. There's not hierarchy. There's not paranoia. There's not a plan. And what happens is that it's friendly. Or it's funny. Like that might be when the sense of humor comes in. Which sometimes is the kind of sense of humor like, oh, this, I was calling that fear. Funny. Or I thought I was afraid of so-and-so, and it's really so much more deep than that, or so much more has nothing to do with me than I thought, or so much more important and has everything to do with me than I thought. But with the smelling, I'm sure that you've had the experience, but it's hard to remember because it's very subtle and ungraspable. It's hard to think about it, and it's hard to make it happen. So don't assume you haven't experienced it, but also just, if we think of smelling and something that smells good to us, the kind of body smile, not just face smile, but body smile, or the kind of also the kind of knowing that's connected to smelling, a really primal kind of knowing. Even if I don't know, what is that smell? So if we think of, so like goats, for example, who really have a good sense of smell, and they go around. One time, Gemma and I were goat sitting and peacock sitting in Spain. There were just only three goats, but they had to be fed and milked. And so sometimes we would walk with them on the rope. They would be on a rope. And so that they could eat more than what. The routine was to tie them somewhere that they had a long rope and they could eat that down. But we would also take them places where it wasn't all eaten down. On the way they would, and then their tongues would come out and just take the whole thing in. Just, it's like a miracle how it would happen. Even thorny things would just go right down. But they wouldn't take it. They were very selective as well. They were really, really selective with the tongue, getting only exactly what they wanted. So the rose would come right off of the rose thing. And then if it was a tender rose branch, then all the thorny branch would go right down the gullet. So some kind of knowing. And people have told me since then that goats actually have a kind of knowing of, a kind of gut knowing. If they're not well, then their nose finds the medicinal thing, and that's what their tongue takes. Right, straight. It's like, it's still rooted in the ground, and the tip of the thing is in their belly, and it's like this continuous line. So not just smell as something that makes us stupid and like mouth-watering and give me food, but smell as a kind of also intelligence that does go straight to the next thing, which is touching. So it by opening us up in a new way, like waking us up in a new way to a different dimension of that formerly negative experience called fear or anger, for example. It wakes up a whole other way of experiencing it. It wakes up this kind of underbelly, underground. And selectively, then what we, the way that we then touch, the way that we then approach or hold or work with, that is completely not filtered through the logical, mental thinking realm. It goes straight from that opening, experiencing, waking up to the that experience of that energy in a new and wordless way, like a curtain is lifted. So another curtain of resistance is lifted, and then the communication that's possible that happens there has an intelligence that we could only kind of know about and describe much later. In the moment, there's not time to think. But something in us does handle the energy totally differently from how we would from the mind, from the thinking, from trying to apply a technique. It's much more subtle, quick, and also strong, visceral, powerful than when we're kind of more tentatively and carefully trying to. There's more intelligence and care in a certain way, and there's much more friendliness, so there's care in that way. There's not a rejection. But there's also not taking poison in, there's taking medicine in. So when we're taking in, when we're touching, the next thing is we are touching. So it's even more, again, in touch with the fear in another step of intimacy. So the goat has smelled, the smell has located something, the tongue has wrapped around it. So then we can feel where it's thorny, where it's soft. But it's the reaching towards the medicinal that has the say. So even when it's thorny, it goes into the throat. So it's just another layer of feeling this as just energy, which in a certain, it's like no longer a body kind of experience, no longer a it's so grounded and so in touch, so in a certain way, so embodied, straightforward, practical, and so non-mental, so non-logical, so non-even emotional, actually. I think that's what I mean by non-bodied. It's not emotional anymore. We could say there's so much disarming from one's own side, so to speak, and so not trying to protect or defend myself from that. And so there's so not a that anymore. That's what I mean by not body. But that actually means that it's so much like visceral body, practical, real, in touch. With traction, like when a wheel can really grip the earth and move forward, we have traction, or when our feet don't slip but could actually push off the ground and take a step. So it's a place of actual real action. There's not spinning wheels. So there's a total disarmament. So there's not destructive, it's not, there's not a destructiveness left. And then the fifth step, which should be tasting, it should be called tasting if we're going by seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, what the sense, normal sense door that's left is tasting. And the way Trungpa voices it is transformation, which I love if we're thinking about eating and the complexities and the miracles and strangeness of what eating is, which is transformation. So we can call it tasting, but it's also like tasting, swallowing, digesting. Transformation. Not Trungpa says not rejecting the basic quality. So not because we're afraid of fear because of our past experiences of fear, or not that we're afraid of anger because of our experiences with anger, but so much an inward experience of the quality of what we had called anger from the inside. And from a place of deep intelligence that is completely unverbal and unmental. Nearly completely unmental and definitely unverbal. Because it is not me relating to it, and so therefore there's not the protection of me against it, which is then me attacking it. There's a discovering of the medicinal quality or the aliveness. The aliveness with its particular precise quality in that experience of what we had called fear or anger or anything. Any time of day, any kind of food, anything. So it's worth considering what allows a human being to experience fearlessness, to experience ourselves as fearless. So even when there's fear, the possibility of being fearless, even in the face of fear, a place that is fearless, that is perfectly happy for fear to come, that knows fear will come sometimes. And to notice where meditation practice in a formal sense can sometimes encourage fear. And to keep coming back to the recovering a fearless place or a fearless quality, which is the same as saying playful, recovering a playful quality, which is the same as saying ruthlessly removing, ruthlessly noticing and freeing ourselves from ideals. Leaving room for what Gurdjieff talks of as passionate curiosity. Are there any questions?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like when you were mentioning these different things in regard to the senses, that with those things and those reactions, normally there's not so much thinking. It's just, oh, that smells good. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And so in those situations or whatever they are, there is this lack of thinking and just spontaneity. Oh, that smells good.
Mm.
It just occurred to me.
Mm-hmm. So this is where we have the need for the discernment of what is the not thinking, not considering, that's reactive, and what is the spontaneous. And often it's mixed. And then to have that teaching come in through words, through thinking, not hopefully not only through thinking, but other ways as well. But having the chance for that teaching about with the metaphor of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, transforming, the metaphor of the sense experiences for our chance of seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, transforming any experience, sense experience, mind state experience, energy experience. That having heard that, there we could leave more room for that deeper intelligence that you're saying, calling spontaneous and not thinking. To leave room for, to kind of honor the quality of how insight tends to happen. So I talked two days ago about not trusting anything, anyone. Gemma talked about trusting. And so we could talk about it as in several ways, like not expecting anyone or anything, not demanding of anyone or anything. To be reliable, or to be how we expect them to be, or whatever. Even if someone wants to be how we want them to be, or even if they want to be, life might take them away from us. So, the chance of staying with our own power. And also allowing trust to appear out of nowhere. And so after the bell rings, what can happen? Sometimes we can trace a direct line of cause and effect of, because I practiced that, then this was in contrast, or this was a fruit of that. This spontaneous, genuine own step or own technique that came was a fruit of that hour before. But mostly, as you're using the word spontaneous and not thinking, even if we can see some of the traces, some of the roots of what sprouts, of what comes up and has a sense of being helpful, genuine, accurate, real, true, not separating, respecting the indirectness also, that we can trace some of the roots, but there's also a lot that we can't trace. It's traceless. But there can be like an active trusting of no thing, or an active trusting that not knowing how to go forward, not knowing how to get through the day, not knowing how to meditate, not knowing how to deal with this fear, anger, whatever. The helpfulness of knowing that I don't know, feeling that openness of not knowing, knowing that I don't know. Does allow something to come up out of nowhere that may have certain thread-like roots that we could trace and may not. So I did think today of one of my favorite poems that if you know me, you've heard, but maybe you love it as much as I do. It's attributed to a Chinese woman named Ziye. But my brother who studies Chinese things told me that it's like a figure to whom many poems are attributed, so we don't know. She might have spoken it or written it or whatever, but a couple thousand years ago. But I just want to check if it makes sense what I'm saying about trusting nothing. It doesn't mean a state of suspicion or paranoia, but actively, in a positive sense, trusting nothing. And sort of honoring how things come out of nowhere. So even everything, even our boring old thoughts, even the ones we think so many times every day, and they also come out of nowhere. But then when things have a kind of, they seem to be an expression of the wholeness or the wider harmony. Not created by one particular cause or one particular technique, but they seem to really express the wholeness. Really honoring how it comes out of some things and out of nowhere. Or out of where. Maybe we can say that. So the poem. It's funny, I love it so much, I feel almost shy to say it out loud. All night, I could not sleep because of the moonlight on my bed. I kept hearing a voice calling. Out of nowhere, nothing answered. Yes. So I'll just say it again, and this time I can tell you that the nothing and nowhere are given in capital letters in the English translation. In Chinese, as far as I know, there's not a way of capitalizing. But the translator put it that way. Let's see. All night I could not sleep because of the moonlight on my bed. So I just love that particular because it's like a kind of honoring. For what reason? Out of what reason? Out of where? Because of the moonlight. Okay. All night I could not sleep because of the moonlight on my bed. I kept hearing a voice calling, and it could be calling me. Out of nowhere, nothing answered, yes. Are there any questions before we end?
Will you post that tomorrow?
Sure, I can post it today. It's a short one.
Sorry, Jen, do you know who wrote that?
It's a tribute in the book that I was given wonderfully 13 years ago. So I've had it in my life for 13 years. It's attributed. In the book, it's given as written by Ziye, a Chinese woman from the first century of the Common Era. But from what I understand, that name and that figure, that woman, was often, like, poems were attributed to her. So then I wonder, I don't know.
I actually do have a quick question.
Yeah, sure.
So that last step of tasting seems different than non-identifying.
Yeah.
Up until that point, it sounded a lot like the thing we posted a couple of days ago about recognize, accept, investigate, non-identify.
Yeah.
Are they different, or am I?
It's different. I mean, in the same way that the hammock and the going towards and eating is different, there's another way that it's not different. Like in the practice of truly non-identifying, if it's not that I'm identifying with something else over here in order to escape that, then in non-identification, that same thing will happen. So in practice, in experience, it will happen. But we do tend to non-identify like that. So, yeah, in that way it's different. And it can be that there's a practice of non-identifying, to go against the habit of identifying. And then we start to be more skillful in non-identifying. So then we can play with, okay, what if I identify? Or if I non-identify so much that the possibility of a gap or the need for a gap between me and that disappears, dissolves. And then that reveals the liveliness and I like to call the intelligence of, so Trungpa talks about honoring the basic quality of that. And it's not just in the kind of more psychological layers where, let's say, with anger or fear, there can be good reasons for the anger and the fear. Like the child who is abused has a good reason to feel anger that he or she was abandoned or hit or whatever. Like the anger needs the room and it makes sense and it's a part of an empowerment to recover that. But it's not only that part. It's something much more along the lines of elixir. It's really the playfulness that's possible, which then allows things that seem courageous to happen, that seem fearless. So instead of being courageous, but like such an extreme of playfulness, an intense playfulness that what would take courage otherwise can happen really lightly and fully, like whoo, like the spontaneous. So on such a subtle level that, so the elixir that has that kind of sense of magic, a little bit will go a long way. So it's on such a subtle level that it's very powerful. The little gesture, the tiny little unselfconscious act is like forever, kind of. It's not just holding the flood at bay for another second and then we've got to come up with another sandbag. It's really a whole other way of handling or being handled, and it's that utter lightness that allows it to be decisive. It's interesting how difficult it is to, I'm finding to describe. So it's a whole, it's such a different way of experiencing ourselves and our mind states and our mind. And it can take actually quite a lot of work to get into that space. A lot of momentum of practice to be in that subtlety and without any over-seriousness, but without wavering also. So that's an encouragement for all the years that may need to go into. But whenever we can just find that after the bell rings kind of clear stream space, it's also right there. And so that's where that we find the elixir, we could more easily recognize it. When it happens spontaneously right away, and also when it happens after long years and decades of practice. And then when it's the kind of state or home.
But in the state that I have, there is already complete surrendering has happened already, no? Otherwise, there would be resistance towards the experience.
So there maybe starts to be then more often that we discover with more and more momentum in our practice over years and through also intensity, not just time, but like genuinely practicing, honestly facing ourselves, our lives. Intensity, receptivity. I think that when I say that third thing, what I mean by that is not just a place to visit and then get washed back into resistance and defense and so on, but that even if it's like we keep on more often discovering, there's more a clear sense of that it's already. It's not something that I have to like stretch to, but like that it is already like that. It is already like that. So both the development of in the inner life is already like that, and the true nature of things is already like that. And those two kind of are, you know, more the sense of the hammock. There, it's quite at ease, and even if there's still development to happen, even if there's still remembering to happen, to practice, etc. But like that's already got my back, kind of. In the hammocky kind of way, not like the armed guard kind of way.
Thinking that this Sufi thing about longing,
mm-hmm.
and like I've often wondered, I've never really understood it, because it seems like that kind of longing that I can't really understand how it can be like a spiritually uplifting kind of thing. But something in like what you're saying, that I was wondering whether that the intensity of that longing,
mm-hmm.
for the master, guru, lover, whatever,
yeah.
that maybe that has that energy,
yeah.
that person is dipping into.
Yeah.
So maybe that's what makes it
work.
Yeah.
The intensity and the receptivity. And it also does describe the challenge of being aware simultaneously of one's potential and one's intense sort of habit energies, conditioning, etc. The contrast between what we experience as our depth or height or potential through meeting another person who seems to embody that or draw that out in us, draw that music out in ourselves or whatever. At the same time, the contrast of the kind of heaviness to kind of bear that stretch has a certain quality of that could be called longing. That it's uncomfortable. And relating to that as a love story, a longing for, does give the possibility of like extreme intensity and receptivity, which is the main thing that's missing for most human beings. So in that poem of about we're made for joy, in the second part where Carl Sandburg says, till then he had been satisfied with himself. So where we want to just, you know, do one or the other. Like we want to get caught up in how transcendent things could be or how transcendent so-and-so is, but or we want to get caught up in how difficult it is and how much work there is to do or how lowly I am or whatever. And to have both stretch is mainly what we don't want to do. And so to call that a love, to make that a love story, you know, is quite, it kind of like technically makes sense. I think for now, like in the sort of like the, I don't know what to call it anymore, but like the kind of dominant culture, our tendency is so much, as Lenny was saying, to focus on the negative and try to work on the negative, and we're so used to tuning into the negative and then reacting to that by trying to get the comfort and convenience, etc., entertainment and so on, that the longing thing is I don't know if it's such a good idea for most of us because it would tend to keep turning on the story of lack, not enough, not good enough, which then turns on, like in the words of Eckhart Tolle, the pain body. So then that's what we can experience, and we're so good at, and we're so practiced, and we put so much energy, we've energized the pain body so much, that in that, when that's on, we hardly or don't feel that there's anything else. If we can feel anything else, or that there could possibly be another perspective or anything else going on other than my pain, we hardly feel it. And so I really would encourage us to practice the other way. So if I meet someone who reminds me of something that I would love to embody or live, then tuning to that as a potential and as resonating with a knowing in myself of how good that is and how important that is and how much I want to live that, and rather than how much I don't. And to be really, 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 really caring about finding and practicing feeling what isn't pain body and what else there is, what else is there in life going on at the same time that we could be in the grip of the pain body, in the grip of the past.
I think that what you're saying is true. If you sort of follow the analogy, you're saying about experiencing meaning experience. So you're digging deep into that pain rather than just ignoring. And from that, it actually, like you said, it becomes transformation.
Yeah. And we're also not meeting pain just because it's painful, but because there's something else in it.
Mm-hmm. I think there's definitely a time for that type of meditation too.
Yeah.
For both, for sure. But I think also some people have gone through more suffering and need to come climb out of a hole, whereas some people are just lighter.
Yeah.
Not necessarily as much healing.
Yeah. Certainly. It's very individual, but I still feel like, in general, most of us, East and West, who are like contributing to that sort of whatever you want to call it, the main culture, dominant culture. What we could practice more of is feeling the tiniest little signs of feeling a sense of belonging, feeling love, feeling joy. And then, okay, feeling the aliveness in fear, feeling the aliveness in anger, feeling the aliveness. But even then, like the fearlessly meeting the difficult, I would recommend like 10% of the day maximum, and not every day. And then when we're more, you know, skillful and there's more expertise, it will happen in its own way. But when we're really developing a practice, like containing that tendency to want to be intense with the difficult and bringing out that intense curiosity and willingness not to know, that can also leave room for and wants to practice and feel the wider harmony and feel for that wing that I have hardly ever used on the other side. And so if we, I didn't think of, I could have gone through that seeing, hearing, smelling, touching, eating thing relating to positive mind states. So that would be something to play with. It's not about any particular, it doesn't, it's not only like, how do I deal with my negative emotions? Okay, seeing, but like anything. So a meal, supper time, anything, the standing in line, the having the food on your plate, the putting it in your mouth, like the liking or not liking the taste, the all of that with that spaciousness. This is just a pattern of life energy, and then meeting it with less and less defense. And more and more as this. More and more as aliveness. And at the same time, each with such a specific quality, a specific basic quality of all, in all these different ways, in that rice, the specific quality, the rice that was cooked by that person at that time of day, even again, another specific quality. And it's, it does happen that the sensitivity to that can grow and not be a problem. Like not just get more and more picky, like, oh, I can only have my rice from that, you know, sort of county or whatever, and cooked only by that person, only between 4 and 5 p.m. or whatever, because otherwise my meditation is crap or whatever. Okay, so it's time to eat. Thank you for being here. It's really a privilege to share this week with you.